When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for the New Books in Japanese Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Garrett Washington about his book, Church Space and the Capital in Pre-War Japan. The book is out from the University of Hawaii Press in 2022. Church Space brings a fresh perspective to the question of the outsized influence of Protestant Christianity in modernizing Japan, and why this influence began from almost the moment that the centuries-long ban was lifted on Christianity in the 1870s. Washington roots his research in the physical space of Protestant houses of worship in Tokyo, exploring the ways that the churches became distinctively Japanese spaces and institutions, which nurtured discourses and practices affecting the social, intellectual, and political development of Japan during the four decades, roughly 1880 to 1920. Which are the focus of the book. Church Space begins with the creation of churches in the treaty ports and their migration into the centers of the new imperial capital, and examines the ways in which Western-style buildings, commissioned by Japanese pastors and built by Japanese architects and builders, came to house congregations with many elite, influential members who together wrestled with the role of Protestant Christianity in the development of modern Japan. And Washington shows critically that both pastoral and lay discourses, especially in the spaces of women's and youth groups, were linked robustly to the public lives and actions of the congregants and the ways in which urban Japanese Protestantism impacted the course of Japan for decades. Okay, Dr. Washington, thank you for joining us today on the podcast. So I wanted to start off by asking you how you became interested in the research project that ultimately led to the book Church Space and the Capital in Pre-War Japan.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question and for having me on the podcast, Nathan. And you can call me Garrett. That's totally fine. So it's kind of a long story. I'm going to try and keep it short, you know, for listeners. I did like an exchange program at Kyushu University about 20 years ago, and a friend of mine from my home university came to Japan to visit me and also some of his family friends. He himself was a Polish American person, and so he had a friend who was a monk in Nagasaki. He was at a Franciscan monastery called Mukinzai no Zono in Nagasaki, and so he took me basically to meet this person. I met this 90-year-old Polish Catholic monk named Seljusz Pęczek. He'd been in Japan for like 70 years. And I was just like, what is going on? You know, how is this person? And he had, you know, like he had like horn-rimmed glasses. He was just he spoke only Japanese and Polish. I was floored. So I was intrigued. And then on top of that, I took a history class also as part of my program of a study abroad at Kyushu University, and the professor was also talking a good bit about you know the history of Christianity in Kyushu, because we were in Kyushu, and so we even went to Nagasaki again, and we talked about, you know, the hidden Christians and all these things that are sort of, you know, small points only in the bigger history that we're often taught of early modern history in Japan. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to focus on that for my study abroad thesis. And then I came back to the U.S. and I was still pretty interested. So I went ahead and did a master's degree on the Jesuits in Japan for my master's degree. And then I decided later on I wanted to keep my focus a bit on the idea of Christianity, but I wanted to look at the modern period And basically, I was curious how the story developed. I was curious where things went. I didn't go into this having a lot of background knowledge, so it was always new discoveries for me. And you know, I was doing my reading, my PhD. I went to Purdue University, and I was reading about various different things. But I was also trying to see where Christianity re-entered the story. And I read a lot of these sort of well-known, groundbreaking scholars like Frederick Nothelfer and Erwin Schiner's books, and John Howe's books, A. Hamish Ion's books as well. And I was, you know, happy to see that there was, again, Christianity was again very visible. And you know, I couldn't really escape that. No matter what I was reading, if it was like a history of politics or journalism or you know, legal history, Christianity still seemed to sort of appear again. At some level, it seemed to be very important. And so, you know, the question was, well, how did this happen? And I felt like these scholars were really trying to answer these questions of how, and this has been going on for like about 6 or 7 decades now, trying to understand, looking back, how this really small religion, with never even like a full percent of the population of Japan, how it was able to have any influence at all. And so what I sort of was able to glean from all these different pieces of scholarship was that there was there were a lot of pieces to it, a lot of different factors, but that they were, you know, they there was sort of a question of, was it cultural imitation? Was it maybe cultural imperialism? Was it the charisma of these Western teachers and spiritual leaders? Was it maybe people sort of experimenting and trying to find the best fit for their modernizing, you know, cultural context? You know, all these things, and these are all accurate portrayals and I think narratives. But what I also saw was that through all these different ways of trying to characterize the reappearance of Christianity, there were a couple of institutions that were really visible, and one of those was Christian schools, missionary schools, or Christian led schools that seemed to have helped bring Christianity back from being this really illegal, you know, punishable, condemned, vilified religion to being something that was, you know, acceptable for the greater public, at least among the educated elite in Japan. And the other seemed to be, but less directly talked about, churches. And so I thought, okay, I see the same names of churches again and again appearing here, a handful of churches. Why don't I just dig in there and see what I can find? And that's how I got to this topic, was sort of through that. And, you know, always wondering though about the how, you know, how do we go from, you know, prohibition and illegality and just so much negative connotation to being relevant and visible in public so much, you know, in the Meiji and Taisho periods.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I mean, you bring up the sort of obvious problem of the quantitative, the number of Christians in Japan versus the qualitative. What effect did it have? What effect did those people and the religion have on Japan as it's modernizing, right, in the late 19th, early 20th century? And so I think it's really interesting that you've, in this book, then settled on the space of the church, very much the physical church and the communities that grew up around it. And this is, you know, to my mind, the sort of new perspective that you're trying to bring very specifically to the urban Protestant Christianity, if I understand it correctly, from the 1890s to really around 1920. So roughly those sort of 3 decades. And so I want to use that as a segue to get us into the book. And for the purposes of the interview, I want to divide that book into roughly 3 sections. And it's not really exactly how the book is arranged, but just when I was reading it, this is intuitively the way that I was dividing it up in my mind. And so we kind of have space, voice, society. So that's chapters 1 and 2, space and spatiality of the church itself and the areas in these urban centers. And then 3 to 5, chapters 3 to 5 focus on voice. You talk about both preachers on the one hand and lay people on the others. And then the last 2 chapters, chapters 6 and 7, are really interested mostly in that interface of Christianity with society. So I hope it's okay to sort of divide it up that way. And start off with what I'm calling section one, even if you didn't. So not trying to put words in your mouth here. But so you make this big overall argument, which I think is the focus of section one, that Protestant Christianity has this impact on society, which is very much linked to and anchored in that physical space of the church itself, right? And you write, Japanese Protestants, many of whom were, as you say, educated, urban, influential people, quote, regularly and openly exchanged ideas on topics that were unarguably social and political. And that they did so and created these discourses in and around the church space, and that was sort of strongly tied to and influential in then the society and politics of the time because of the people that they are, right? So there's this direct line from the space of the church where these discourses are being created through these influential people out into society. How did this particularly Japanese Protestant church space develop then? And why is this so important? I'd love it if you could tell us a little bit about this really interesting map collection that you have at the beginning here that accompanies these early chapters.
Sure, yeah. So lots of good questions about sort of this first section. And the way that you've divided it up, I think, makes a lot of sense. And also, I think that the way that you also asked the question of Japanese church space, I think, is also important here. So the book really tries to approach the questions of space going back to both like urban space or physical urban space, as well as built space. And they're obviously very much intertwined, but I wanted to understand them separately as well to see what the dynamics that were occurring in each of these two different areas. So the urban space or the built space, sorry, the urban space question, I wanted to interrogate how did church space develop spatially? Like where did it begin and where did it move to? And what was behind these moves? And what I show in the book, or what I try to show at least in the book, is that there was really a shift in church space from being located in treaty ports, which were Western spaces, which had a lot of special status and association elements to them, to more urban central locations that were located really in the heart of urban places and urban areas. And I'm focusing on Edo, on Tokyo, but I'm also thinking about this as it applies to other, major metropolitan areas in Japan as well. But in Tokyo, we see the these church spaces that first developed were really they belonged to missionaries and missionary organizations as part of these sort of foreign treaty port area. And then we see that there's a move that is encouraged, in fact, by missionaries. That is carried out at the behest and under the guidance of these young, ambitious Japanese pastors and converts to establish churches in Tokyo proper. They really have an idea of Tokyo as an imperial capital, this idea of Teito or imperial capital that has been discussed by a few different scholars in great detail, and they bring this idea with them, and it justifies their move to where first of all to the capital itself, but also where in the capital. So I'm also interested in where they move their churches to, or where they found new churches in the capital. So they established their churches sort of on the edge of Tokyo, nearest to the treaty ports, but then they move pretty quickly actually to the areas that they see as most important for this new modernizing Japan. You know, the soon to be erected imperial diet, the imperial university, which stays still located in Hongo, or at least at the main campuses, to the area where in the Bancho neighborhood, where the residences are of all of these important, powerful members of government are located, or their official residences, as well as sometimes just their normal homes as well. So they're really trying to draw a certain audience, a certain membership to their churches, and a certain kind of visibility amongst a certain population. And their choices about where to place these churches, and also where to replace these churches when they burn down or when they are in disrepair or when they need to expand, they're still guided by these same priorities. So that was sort of what that first chapter was trying to show, was this movement. And it really is, you know, it's mappable, right? And so in that first chapter, I used maps to really try and understand that movement. You know, I was really lucky to have been able to sort of begin using basic GIS to take maps and to plot the points at the different phases of movement of these four major churches that I'm studying, that I'm focusing on. And also I wanted to give that research method back to the reader, so they could see how I was, you know, that they could identify which church was, so they could understand my process, and they wouldn't just take my word for it, but they could actually see this transition happening. And they could also see the different, I mentioned all these various locations. I mentioned, you know, the Homo so-and-so, or I mentioned the different educational institutions that are in a different neighborhood. And I wanted to be able to show the reader, you know, just how far it was on the map, and so they could see that. And I think mostly, you know, it's successful in that. And of course, it makes the book bigger and more costly to make, but I think it was important for me to show that to the reader. The second chapter, very much tied to the first, was about the question of built space. And I guess what I also should mention before I get into that second chapter is that there also was a clear separation between foreign and Japanese space, right? And this goes back to, you know, the Edo period and the creation of Dejima, this strategy really applies again into the modern era and, in fact, and so the treaty port really was this separate space. And so it's really interesting to see how the spaces are able to move from this peripheral foreign space into Japanese space. So a lot of the same themes apply to the second chapter as well. I'm really interested in looking at how the church as a built space also changes. The first churches that are established in Japan in the sort of late Tokugawa period and then in the early Meiji period are entirely Christian missionary-funded sort of commissioned buildings. And these missionaries are all from European or American origins. And I wanted to understand, okay, are we just going to be seeing churches that are going to be built in the capital or near the capital or in major urban areas? They're also going to be missionary products built for and by missionaries, or is there a different kind of space being built here? When I first came across images of churches, I didn't realize, I thought that, oh, these are Western looking churches, right? So maybe there's just a sort of transplant happening. But the more I've tried to understand the processes that work, the more I became able to see that these are in fact a hybrid space. So the churches that are established in the capital, closer to all these important locations, and that are built and rebuilt there by Japanese pastors, they are, on the one hand, you know, very much they look Western. They have this the aura of Westernness, the Western moral authority, and this is part of what makes them special. It sort of carries over a lot of the associations and protective qualities that a church building would have had it been in a treaty port. And that's part of what I argue gives these churches a special status as a building, and protects them from potential, you know, intrusion by the state, those kinds of things, or even attacks by people who might be anti-Christian as they pass by. But they're also very much Japanese spaces, and I wanted to show that my research really did demonstrate that, and why I argue that. So what makes the space also Japanese? And so very much Japanese. One of the elements I wanted to highlight is the funding of churches. These churches are funded almost entirely by the church members themselves, who are almost entirely Japanese, if not all entirely Japanese. And so I try and describe that process. The church buildings are also, when the money does not come from only Japanese funds, it is funded through fundraising that is again Japanese led. So we have Japanese pastors who may even go to the United States to find funding, but not from missionary organizations, but from individuals who share their vision. So missionary organizations would try actually throughout the Meiji period to contribute to these new, this new generation of church buildings. And they actually would be, again and again, they would be turned down. There was a desire of Japanese pastors to really have the church building be their church building. And that ties into my second point about these church sites, these church built spaces. It's that the Japanese church spaces were, you know, in the same way that they were placed and located very, very intentionally in certain places, based on these Japanese pastors' desires and visions for the church space, they also were commissioned and they were envisioned by these pastors, as you know, and so we see them being built according to their own desires. You know, I try and take a lot of different quotes and to show a lot of evidence of how these pastors really envisioned the church space to accomplish certain things, to look a certain way, both on the exterior but also on the interior. And then I also look at who they chose to build their churches, and these churches are they're very much designed and built by Japanese architects, and these architects are, you know, largely architects who are being trained by Westerners at the Architecture Institute at the University of Tokyo, or at that time the Imperial University, but they are very much Japanese individuals, right? They're grappling with the same kinds of cultural pull between Japan and the West that the pastors are, and that process I think is actually very Japanese as well. So that these elements make the space Japanese in that sense. But also I'm interested in a lot of these sort of more, these sort of theoretical propositions about what defines space, what gives space meaning. And I also want to demonstrate that the space, and this is what happens throughout the rest of the book, is that these spaces are used by entirely Japanese members or memberships or congregations. That this use also gives Japanese meaning to the space. So all those things together make this a hybrid space, but that is on the one hand very Western, but on the other hand extremely and very sort of, I think, proudly and intentionally Japanese.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, at the risk of oversimplifying a little bit, what I got out of this, both reading it and then listening to you summarize, is that, you know, you have sort of increasingly Japanese spaces in increasingly Japanese spaces, right? That you're moving from the treaty ports, which are these sort of very, very mostly Western sort of spaces, and the churches are moving further into the sort of center of Japanese-ness, right? Symbolically, the imperial capital and its important institutions, and at the same time, the church spaces themselves are increasingly Japanese, right? In the sense that they are designed, built, inhabited in that sense by Japanese clergy, congregations, etc. And this is a really sort of nice transition that you started to give us to, and those are then productive spaces, which is what you really get into in section two, thinking about not the space, but the discourses that are produced in those spaces. So I want to move on to talk about that, which is chapters 3 and 4. Here you're looking first at pastoral discourse, where you're drawing out the tensions between these more sort of universalist or I guess progressive visions rooted in Protestant values, and the more colloquial nationalism that comes up in their sermons, pronouncements, etc. And I guess one of the big questions here is why pastors at this time felt freer to engage with controversial topics than their counterparts in other religions, Buddhism being the most obvious of them. And then at the same time, you also write, quote, the nation and its destiny were at the heart of many Tokyo pastors' sermons. So then how did this sort of ecumenical mesh with the colloquial, the universal and the national? So I wonder if you could help us to untangle that.
Yeah, definitely. So in thinking about the first part of your question about the pastors and their ability to, and their impression of more freedom to speak about, you know, current events and these kinds of topics and their counterparts. I didn't mention this, but one of my hopes was also to sort of try and contextualize Christianity, especially the Protestant variety of Christianity, amongst other religious alternatives in the Meiji period. There were Catholic, Roman Catholic missionaries and many converts. There were Greek Orthodox converts. And of course, there were Buddhist and Shinto movements at the same time. And so part of my job was to try and sort of make sense of what made the discourse and the discursive sort of freedom or ability of Christianity in the church space different. So I think that I would focus on, first of all, there was a very clear impression amongst the pastors that they were in a space that was condoned, that was allowed to have these kinds of discussions. They knew Western educators, Western missionaries, and this is how they talked. They didn't shy away from talking about things that were right important, about gender issues, about the future of Japan. So that, I think, was in some ways they carried over this feeling of entitlement from their encounters with Westerners, I think, into this space. So that's one area I think I would highlight. Another is that I think that beyond their ability, I'm not sure that they themselves commented on feeling freer to speak. They just did it, right? And that, I think, also speaks to their passion for these topics, right? So I think that the people who become Protestant pastors in the Meiji period, these are almost entirely from the samurai class. Almost entirely, this has been written by several scholars over the past several years, the past several decades. They come from this place of having been disinherited or disentitled. Many of them were actually on the losing side of the Meiji Restoration. So they're really trying to find their place in society, but they also come from a place of great pride and of ambition. So what we see is that they believe that Christianity is the religion that's going to make them, but also Japan, a more modern, advanced, successful, powerful country. And this sort of this drive, this passion, this determination, right, I think really drives their discourse. And so as they talk about these topics that are somewhat common to other kinds of Protestant discourse, I would say things like being proactive and being generous and sharing and not being selfish and about brotherhood, for example. These themes they really feel, I think, able to, but they definitely act upon this freedom of trying to make their listeners, their audiences, their congregations hear that these are topics that are relevant to Japan and its future, and to sort of provide a blueprint. So they really, I think, felt that they were in a position of leadership, and this was what they had learned in their domain as they were young samurai. This is what they learned when they went to, many of them went to, were educated in missionary or missionary-led institutions where they were again told, you are the future of Japan. So they really bring that message, they take it to heart, and they bring that message with them into the space of the church. And from the pulpit, they're trying to give these new proactive, modern, very modern visions of individualism, of blueprints for how an individual in this new modernizing Japan should be and why. So that, I think, is an important element to mention there. They are also trying to define a new Japanese essence. And so chapter 3 really is about taking some of the elements of this Japaneseness that they believe may be detrimental. So they do attack some of the trends or cultural elements that they see as holding the Japanese people back. They're very critical of Buddhism, for example, as a passive religion, right? These kinds of things. But we see the Japaneseness question even more strongly in chapter 4, as they're trying to really take head on the question of what it means to be a Christian and to be Japanese. And they're really trying to argue that Christianity is, in fact, the right religion for Japan, and that it should be allowed to exercise itself in that way. And they pull examples of Christianity being used by other important figures and important people in the history of Western nations. They draw upon, so that they're trying to teach their listeners the role of Christianity in making a strong nation. And one of the things that I enjoyed seeing also is that even when they sometimes might have different points of view about the national destiny, because we have more conservative and we have more liberal pastors who are part of this cohort of church building, church founding, influential pastors, the reference point of the nation is still very much central to their arguments and their discussions. And I also tried to demonstrate that this is also a way to see that the sort of Shinto secular that has been talked about by some of my colleagues in the past few years, like Trent Maxey and Jason Josephson, is very much part of their way of thinking as well, even though they're operating in a space that they define is entirely Japanese Christian, Japanese Protestant Christian. So they're fiercely nationalist, and their love for Japan is, you know, very much a part of their discourse, and it's very much something that they don't shy away from talking about. The 1890s in Japan is a time where things could have gone very differently. There was a lot of there was a publication of Imperial Educational Rescript, which is a document that re-emphasized the importance of sort of Neo-Confucian values and loyalty to the state. The author of that also wrote his own text afterwards, a whole book that condemned Christianity as a un-Japanese religion. So they're really responding to these criticisms by trying to really demonstrate Christianity's Japanese-ness. And they are able to, you know, draw connections between the Japanese history and Japanese sort of Japanese cultural identity and these themes that they have found in the Bible and in other sort of Christian stories to make it more relevant to Japan. So you ask about how do they sort of, you know, how do they make these two areas, you know, work together, the fiercely nationalist perspective with the more progressive and universalist ideas. This is a challenge for them, I think, across the board. There are some people, I think, that choose one church over another because the pastor does a better or more perhaps preferable job in finding the balance between these two. But in a way, we're also talking about people who are working in they are doing this as well as any other person is doing this in the world of you know, proselytization. How well did American pastors, you know, for example, who or American missionaries, how were they able to make these two, you know, worked these two different sort of tensions work? I guess that the sort of resolution seems to always come to, or very often come to, the acting, you know, on behalf of your fellow Japanese citizens is the way to make Japan better. And so they kind of put Christianity into a position of being the moral or in the sort of ideological pathway to go from being, you know, Japanese to go from being, they want to sort of displace, I think, if the hierarchy system of Confucian thought. They want to insert Christianity in its place and argue that it's an ideology as well as a belief system that will allow people to behave a certain way, to act a certain way that will then allow them to, in doing so, support the nation, and that the nation will be better off afterwards. So by tying all these different ideas to the nation, that I think is more or less their solution to this quandary that I think actually plagues religious leaders, you know, even throughout this period across the world.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, there's, you know, that sort of internationalist nationalism or nationalist internationalism, right? And seeing the kind of the local benefits of the universal and the universal benefits of doing the local, right? You know, by bettering yourself and your community, you better the world. And by bettering the world, you better yourself and your community, right? So I think it's a productive tension, as I think you're suggesting. So that's the clergy, right? But one of the things that I found surprising when I was reading the book is the attention that you pay to the lay discourse as well. In, you know, opening up a book that is, you know, partially sort of a church history. I found that it was all actually much more of, in that sense, a community history than I was expecting. And that's the thing that you focus most on in chapter five. And you sort of frame that as, you know, both a choice that obviously you're making, but one that reflects your understanding that lay participation is a defining feature of Japanese Protestantism in this three-decade period from 1890-ish to 1920-ish. And so tell us about this lay discourse, and in what ways was it overlapping with or differing from the clergy discourses that we've been talking about? And then also, of course, how did it get reflected in actual, in actions, in works, in society?
Yeah, so when I came at these questions initially, because I was seeing these lay, these Japanese individuals who had these ties, you know, that were mentioned in passing to Protestant Christianity. And I knew about some of their contributions to society before. They've been written about by a lot of different scholars. And so I kind of, in a sense, worked backwards. And this was my chance to then go back and ask myself, what did the church experience for them look like? And a big part of that was indeed them listening to sermons, you know, and so I focused a lot in chapters 3 and 4 on the sermons that were given in the Reihaido or the worship space or the Sankaido. And I wanted to sort of see if themes that seemed to be appearing in other parts of this sort of Protestant network, social movements, if they were appearing in pastoral discourse. And in fact they were. And so what I was doing in chapter five was then trying to examine these major themes that were, I think, just, well, I mean, I was trying to ask what were they talking about at church amongst these lay people. And I came across, for example, this really interesting set of lectures by the Imperial University professors, including the perhaps the most vocal anti-Christian critic in Japan, the same person who also authored the long anti-Christian work following the Imperial Educational Rescript in 1892 himself. He actually comes to give a talk as well as part of the sort of science lectures at one of these churches. And this happens in the 1890s. And so when I came to that, I thought, I really need to understand better what's happening in amongst the lay people as they take the podium or the lectern. What are they talking about at church, right? And how is that part of this? And you know, I just spent time going through the church bulletin that I found in a closet in one of these churches in Tokyo, and looking at various other sources to get a sense of what the different topics that were being discussed were. And having already done a lot of background work on the context, I think it was able to lift out a few themes that were relevant to pastoral discourse, but also to larger social movements and trends. One of them was the woman question, right? Talking about the place of women in society. You know, what I was able to see was that women's groups and men's groups were both actively sort of hosting lectures about the so-called woman problem, the Fujin Mondai in Japanese. And this was not unique to this space. But what was sort of interesting is that there were not that many places to discuss these things openly, right? And that I was able to see the sort of real questions that were being asked by Christians about women's place in society, and sort of to get a sense of also the temperature, how progressive were their ideas about these things, you know. And what we really get to see is that there was a very strong sort of progressive, not always entirely feminist, but at least, you know, pro-women's suffrage, pro-women's political involvement, that was part of what was talked about at church. And I was able then to go back and see, well, in fact, the pastors themselves in their sermons also talk about women's rights, not necessarily as directly as calling for suffrage, although that happens occasionally, but in terms of the ideals that they are trying to promote. They do mention women, and they mention, for example, women and their role in the ministry of Jesus and these kinds of things. So there are these threads that do connect these two parallel spaces, the lay and the clergy space. I also was, you know, I read a lot about also about the labor movement in Japan, which also is very much tied in theory to Protestantism. The names of Protestant, you know, men and women, as well as those who have ties to Protestantism, are pretty, they've been pretty large in this area as well. And so I went into, I spent time looking for things about that, and I found lots of lectures and speeches and conversations about labor, about socialism as well, also an important topic that's discussed a lot as well. And again, I was trying to also see, okay, in fact, there are links between this as well as, and some of the more sort of global or international or cosmopolitan encouragements of the pastors in chapters 3 and to some extent also in chapter 4 as well. So I, in a sense, I was always trying to find these connections and see if they were there. And we find the same kinds of themes, but more concretely talked about in these spaces. So before we talk even about activism or actual work and action, there was this space for talking about these themes and these sort of the, you know, I enjoyed reading, for example, about church members who were announcing a labor dispute that was happening, or who were talking about the unjust treatment of miners in Ashio, for example, a copper mine. So there are these moments like that I was able really to just dig into in this chapter, and I think will shed light on these topics, which are somewhat, I think, well known in the history of Japan, but not as a topic talked about in a church space, and not as a topic that may have had the activism that around these that we know about more about today, having had links to the church space. And that, I think, is a good segue into like the last part of the of your question, which was about sort of the real action, right? Part of this, the carrying of these the pastor presented ideals and ideas and et cetera, and the lay discourse. What does that look like in terms of actual work, right? And actual taking action. So chapter 6 is about church-based organizations or church-based groups. And you know, there were three main groups. There were women's groups, men's groups, and there were youth groups, which were mostly men's groups. And then we also see that there were parallel, although oftentimes a little bit less celebrated or less supported, there were also women's groups, or I should say young women's groups as well, that took shape in the church space. And so I wanted to talk about these different groups. There also were groups for elder women as well, elderly women as well, and they also were very much involved in certain things. So I kind of spent time looking at what each of these groups was trying to do. For example, I was able to link the elder women's group, for example, to the fundraising for church building or church rebuilding. So I was able to see what they were doing in that sense. But looking at the youth groups and the women's and men's group in particular, there is this very proactive effort to organize social involvement. So they were really looking very outwardly. They were really interested in, raising money for, the victims of a great flood in the Tohoku, for example, or they were very much interested in addressing these kinds of issues. They talk about these issues and they also try and raise money. They would deliver things. But I also found that there was a bit of a divide, and that the young men's youth group was very much oftentimes a sort of an intellectual group. It was a sort of a cocoon of intellectual exchange to sponsor events, for example, like the one I mentioned before in chapter 5. To have intellectuals come and give talks and speeches, and this also happens, for the women's groups as well, for the young women's groups as well. But it's the Fushinkara women's groups as well. But the men's groups really focused, I think, very heavily on intellectual exchange, and you know, many of them were students at Japan's top universities, and they were sort of bringing the debate and intellectual exchange environment of those those different institutions into the church space. They created journals. For example, the most famous Xinjin, for example, is an intellectual journal that is all, it's really all about, you know, Christianity, but also social issues very much. And so we see that the discourse that was being sort of talked about in lectures that were being given is reflected in the discussions that are being, in the articles that are being published in this journal. So that was a major focus of the young men's group at these churches, I would say, for the most part. But there also is, you know, there are moments of them being socially engaged, whereas the women's groups, or the Fujinkai, the women's groups, they really were much more focused on directly engaging with society, actually making concrete social change. And so while they do try and organize and to bring relief to victims of disaster, these kinds of things, they're really interested in trying to make more concrete change around, for example, the woman question. So they would invite experts to come talk about the woman question, and they would invite lay speakers to come talk about them in church as well. But they also are very much interested in sort of more proactive efforts. We see them, for example, when there's the Fujinkai, for example, is at the heart of efforts to thinking back to, for example, the disaster relief. They are the ones who organized the disaster relief around their churches in the wake of the great Kanto earthquake. So they're very much involved in that sense. But they also are, very much interested in supporting what they see as important movements that will help lead to more social change. So for example, the women are not allowed to attend the imperial diet, and we see this being discussed, but also the women have their own publication, oftentimes their own journals at church as well, that discuss these issues. But we also see them sort of trying to support movements by individuals who are trying to fight against these kinds of issues, whether it be concubinage or whether it be one's inability to attend the imperial diet. And then we also see that there are a lot of like public welfare and educational programs that are being carried out by women's groups. One of the things that I've worked on since or as I finished the book was the ways in which women were also tied to efforts to deal with, for example, during the Russo Japanese War, we see the church space being used to provide moral support for families and for soldiers. And the Fujinkai, or women's group, were the ones who organized the creation or the assembly of these comfort bags that were sent to soldiers. We see them also sending money or sending notes to the parents of soldiers. So they're just very, very much focused on trying to act on their ideals from the church space, to the exterior. And then chapter 7 really is about trying to highlight a number of individuals who I think just exemplify the people taking action on their Christian ideals and on also interactions that were taking place at church. And so we have, one of the individuals I talk about, for example, was the founder of perhaps the leading periodical for young women. Let's see, Shufu Natomo. So it's the housewife's friend. He, some would call him sort of, the king of periodicals. He talks about, for example, the ties that his church experience and his encounters and his work in the youth groups, both the youth group and the women's group at his church, and in this case it was Hongo Church, how that helped to inspire him to create this publication. And I spend time on each of these individuals just trying to tie all these things together, the church space, encounters in the church space, discourse in the church space, to their actual social and political or cultural actions. And they stand as, they stand as examples, not as, an entire, an effort to cover every Christian or every churchgoer. I also wanted to highlight individuals who went to church but didn't become Christians, because they're also part of the group of people who still talk about church experiences, even when they do not eventually sort of become Christian or stay Christians. And they also are worth including here. And this helps also to explain why we see people, you know, the impact of Christianity beyond those who are actually Christians. People came to church and they listened to lectures and speeches, and they gave themselves speeches as well. They were part of these networks, even when they were not themselves Christians. And so this also speaks to the larger sort of, you know, amplitude, the larger space, the larger the larger population and of Christian impacted people, or of Protestantism impacted people in Japan. And I try and talk about different kinds of people. So I talk about a nursing and doctor. I think I talk also about a business person as well, a businessman as well. I talk about different kinds of individuals, just to give a different, to show how these different factors or aspects of life are tied to their church experience for these various figures. So that, yeah. I think is in a nutshell the how the society, you know, facing part of the church is addressed in those last two chapters of the book.
Right, and you've done a really, you know, nice job here of summarizing and also expanding on something that you say in the book about that, which is that the subject of the book, urban Protestant Japanese Christianity, right, with all those qualifiers, but is really characterized by the ways that it helped women especially, but also some of these youth groups, and again individuals, to collect to connect their faith and their ideals and the learning and discourses that they encountered and internalized in the church space with the society and the world of politics and whatever beyond that church space. And so, yeah, so that's a, I thought that was a sort of interesting transition that we have there, right? From the physical space of the church to the voice of the pastors to then, okay, what are people doing with that, right? And I think this is really to me, the structure of the book is, how does the Japanese church then have that influence, right? This is a really nice place to, I think, wrap that discussion up. And I wanna thank you for doing that. But before I let you go, I do wanna ask you what it is that you're up to these days, now that you've got the book out, and you're probably have some side projects and new things that you're working on. So can you tell us about some of that?
Sure. Yeah. So one of the people that I talk about in my book is a woman named Hiroka Asako. And she was one of Japan's wealthiest and most powerful women in the late Meiji period. She is very much a gung-ho, candid speaker at the women's group events, the Fujinkai events, at some of these churches. And she also was involved with the Japan YWCA. And so we see her name appear in the book. I also take one of her speeches, for example, in the chapter on lay discourse, and use that to sort of, as one of my areas of analysis. I talk about her speech in that context. So I came to identify her as an interesting person and a historical subject during this other book writing process. And so I decided to work on her again, this time more directly, for my next project. So I'm doing what I'm calling is sort of a critical spatial biography of Hiroka Asako, in sort of the who is she? She was born into the very prominent Mitsui banking family, but as a, you know, as a woman, as a daughter of that family, she had to, you know, she had a lot of constraints placed upon her, both just because she was a woman, but I think that it's important to realize that a lot of merchant women early modern Japan had a lot of influence and power. But because she was in the Mitsui family, the visibility, right, and prominence of that family led, I would say, sort of led them to impose especially strict gendered norms upon her. But she was someone who didn't want to conform to those gender norms. She wanted to learn the abacus. She wanted to be involved in the banking. She wanted to be assertive and to have a role. She wanted to learn the Chinese. She wanted to read the Chinese classics. And so there sort of is a narrative that exists. You know, she would hide in the closet while her brothers got their lessons, or her cousins got their lessons from the Confucian tutor, and then she would take notes. And she basically was sort of very much self-taught. She was even forbidden at age 13 from reading because she was doing too much of it. And so if you fast forward a bit, you know, she marries into another failing but very prominent merchant family. Her husband was not very interested in actually running his company, and he essentially, after several failures, lets her take over. And so she is this sort of shadow director of the family company. This is the Kajimaya of the Hiroka family, and you know, she is able to acquire some mines in Kyushu. She creates a life insurance company, and she also creates Kajima Bank, and through those she becomes very wealthy. And then she also uses her influence and money to be the primary benefactor of Japan Women's University, which is arguably the first real university for women in Japan. So this, what I'm interested in is, you know, not just telling that story, but also trying to retell that story, because part of the issue is that this story has been largely forgotten. She was very famous, and, you know, missionaries were excited. She became a Christian when she was about 60. And so she became, her last decade of life, she was a gung-ho Christian, but before that she was not. And, you know, she brought her business sense and her candid, sometimes rude, honesty to the you know, the Christian events and those kinds of things. So she was very, I think, very famous during her life. But if you ask anyone in Japan today, no one has any idea who she is. And so my goal is to sort of try and explain why that happened, how she became invisible. Part of it has to do with the fact that she had to act always in her husband's name until he died in 1904. And so trying to find actual traces of her doing things requires a bit more digging. You know, the university that she helped to found, Japan Women's University, is an example. You know, that all of the gifts that she made before his death were in his name. But if you go back and you look carefully, this is being more and more made visible these days in the past like 5 or 6 years. You know, we can see that she was the one going to knock on the doors of these major barons and counts to ask them to sign the petition to start the university. She was the primary person, you know, making the funds. She was the one who also was able to convince her brother to donate the land that they had in Meijido to locate the school there. So she's very much someone who was visible, but then became invisible. And I'm interested in that. I'm also interested in showing how space, different kinds of space, were involved in her journey. So right now I'm working on, you know, for example, her role in the actual space of the mines. You know, she went to the mines, she went down into the mine pits. She, you know, she carried a pistol just in case. You know, she was very much a hands-on, directly engaged manager, even though on paper she was not visible at all. And also, so space there, space in her different households, her mobility, but also interested in trying to challenge the sort of heroine narrative that is possible to have about someone like that, and to see if we can put her in context and talk about women's women entrepreneurs or women in business in general in the Meiji and in the Meiji period in a different way. So we can try and understand what they actually were able to do and to sort of de-exceptionalize her case. She actually was involved in a lot of important networks, and a lot of men had to also support what she was doing for it to be able to work. And so I'm trying to tell a story that's much more nuanced and less sort of hagiographic, while still trying to give, you know, her props for being a pretty impressive individual. So that's a book project I'm working on.
That's a fine balance, right? Because it does sound like she's kind of a badass, but it's very tempting to write the hagiography. Yeah, sure. Well, that sounds like a fantastic project. And I hope we will be able to have you back on the podcast with a whole book about that sometime in the near future. But until then, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, and take care.
Thank you, Nathan. And it's been a pleasure.